Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to Deconstructive Criticism. I'm your host, Aaron Flam. Today we're joined by a distinguished guest, Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Conricus. Having recently concluded his tenure as IDF spokesperson, he's now lending his expertise as a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Our conversation will delve into the nuances of Israel's conflict with Iran. A heartfelt expression of gratitude goes out to the special donors whose generosity has made this insightful journey to Israel possible. If you're inspired to support our endeavors, consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/AaronFlam, or for our Swedish listeners, you can donate via Swish at 0768943737. Lieutenant Colonel Conricus' military odyssey began in the Givati Brigade, progressing through the ranks to serve as a combat commander along Israel's most challenging frontiers. Notably, he was the first IDF officer to serve at the United Nations headquarters. His voice became familiar in the West following the tragic events of October 7th, as he engaged with media to convey the on-ground realities of Israel's situation. My prior discussions with Jonathan, once in the early summer of 2023 and again shortly after the October 7th atrocities, provided valuable insights. In this episode, we reconnect in Tel Aviv amidst the city's vibrant hub at a busy cafe on Saturday the 24th of February 2024, where Jonathan, having completed his IDF service, offers personal perspectives on the situation Israel finds itself in, and more broadly, the West. Join us for a candid and enlightening dialogue. Enjoy. Welcome once again to Deconstructive Criticism, Jonathan Conricus, the man with the hardest job in the world.
Thank you for having me again. Now it's not my job anymore as a reservist.
Oh, really?
Like so many other Israelis on the 7th of October, I reported for duty even before being called, but reported for duty. And then I did 3 months in active reserves, and they ended at the end of the year. And since then, yes, I've still been talking and explaining and responding to media inquiries, but it has been on my own accord and on the accord of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, a U.S. think tank that I'm now a senior member of. But it's been representing myself, and it's a rather liberating experience not to be in uniform anymore and to be able to share the information I have and not only have to stick to a certain message page, but actually say what I believe. Not that I was, that I said anything that I don't believe before, but now I have the liberty to say a few more things, which I'm sure your listeners will enjoy.
Yes, they will appreciate it a lot. So congratulations on your new job.
Thank you.
First of all, US think tank, ooh la la.
Yes. And not just any think tank. It's a think tank that I think I can identify with and really believe in what they do, and very, very smart people there. Founded a little bit more than 20 years ago by Cliff May and a partner. Today headed by Mark Dubovitz, he's the CEO. Some of the more known names are Jonathan Chanzer, Rich Goldberg, and then they have experts on everything between here and China. Of course, focusing on Russia, Iran, China, all of the illicit and evil regimes of the world, the non-democracies who are threatening democracies. That's what the FTD focuses on. And of course, Israel is very much at the heart of what it does, but it's a US-focused think tank. So it's not only about Israel now, because there's a war, there's a lot being done and written about Israel, but a lot is about China and its hostile policies towards Taiwan and its belligerent activities around the world, Russia and Ukraine, of course. FTD has been a primary source of information for media and others around the world when it comes to the war in Ukraine. And they have a very, very strong Middle East program, which I'm part of now.
What a lucky coincidence for me, because I'm focusing quite a lot on Iran, Russia and China for the last year and a half, I think, in my podcast. Even before October 7th.
Yeah, I know you do. And you've had interesting guests, which I think they share what I've heard a few episodes. It's some of them are very personal accounts, first encounter, first body, encounters of situation in Iran, Ukraine, Russia. FTD, they provide, it's based on experts who have the language skills and come from those areas. So they have Russian speakers, Farsi speakers, Pashto speakers, and of course Arabic speakers who grew up and came from those communities. But it's, academic and think tank level, goes through a rigorous vetting process, and information there is very, very solid.
So where does the free world stand at the moment?
Good question. Embattled. And from, my little Israeli perspective, sometimes it's amazing that we don't get automatic support from other countries around the world who are allegedly supposed to share our interests and our values. And every once in a while, when there's a spike in criticism against Israel, or where there are more harsher statements by Europeans or by the Americans against Israel, I pinch myself and I ask myself, if they were in the same situation that we are, and we have been since October 7, but even before that, would they would they think it reasonable for anybody to be pontificating or dictating terms to them if they were fighting for their very existence against a very, very brutal enemy, which has given very clear examples of his brutality and his future brutal intentions? I think that the answer would be no. I don't think that they would expect others to implement what they're calling on Israel to implement. Rafah, as an example. We're now at the situation in Gaza where the last stand of Hamas is essentially four Hamas battalions that are left in Rafah, maybe another battalion of stragglers that have, made it from after fighting in Khan Yunis and other places. So let's say five battalions, but four proper battalions with command and control, logistics and operational capabilities. They are the last ones left after 22 total battalions existed on October the 7th, including the Nukba forces, which of course launched the raid into Israel. Calling on Israel not to launch the strike on Rafah and not to finish the job militarily is basically telling us, well, we don't want you to win the war. We want you to leave a way open out for Hamas so that they can rebuild in the very imminent future and that they'll continue to govern the Gaza Strip. And from my point of view, that is, I cannot understand why any country, let alone allies of Israel and friends of Israel, would call on that to happen. And I think it's even reckless to consider it. It's very clear from a military point of view, Hamas needs to be defeated, and the IDF, through hard work, danger, casualties, and blood, has been able to reach this very good tactical position. And now what needs to be done is to finish the job militarily and launch the next, which will be a very long and challenging process of rebuilding Gaza, de-radicalizing it, and finding some or implementing some kind of strategy that will bring security for Israel, but prosperity and long-term stability for Gazans. And that's easier said than done.
Yes, I think that might be the most complicated part of the process. But as we sit here now, there are things happening in Paris. There are hostage negotiations. Hamas wants a ceasefire, Hudna, at least.
Yeah, it's good that you say Hudna, because for people who don't know what a ceasefire, what the difference between a ceasefire and a Hudna, Hudna, from an Islamic point of view, is a temporary ceasefire in operations, in fighting, in order to get ready for the next stage of fighting when conditions are better. That's the Islamic interpretation, and that's what it means. When somebody says, let's have a Hudna, it means, now I'm weak, now I'm not in a good position, give me some time to rest so that I can get stronger and then resume fighting on my terms. That's what Hudna means.
Yes. So do you see these negotiations leading anywhere? Because Hamas's demands so far for a ceasefire has been basically they want Israel to capitulate.
They want Israel to knowingly forfeit all of its gains, not to accomplish its goals in the war, and basically allow Hamas to continue to exist and to govern the Gaza Strip and to have their military infrastructure more or less intact in order to rebuild it in the immediate future. That's what Hamas is asking for and demanding. They made these outlandish claims, I think, knowing very well where Israel's red lines are, what's applicable, what isn't applicable. I think our politicians, Israeli politicians, and cabinet meetings are way too exposed. There is recklessness and lack of discipline with Israeli ministers who talk too much, who advertise what our red lines are. And accordingly, Hamas could say, okay, well, I understand that the Israelis are here and here. This is the outer red line. So they made demands that are even far beyond it. Which is a shame, because now it puts us in a dilemma. If we want to get our hostages back, which we do, 134 Israelis are there, probably 31 are no longer alive, maybe more than that, maybe up until 50 are no longer alive, but let's assume that there's 100, maybe a little bit less, live Israelis, and of course the bodies that we need to get back as well. And when they make that kind of a demand, they know very well where Israel stands, and they make an outlandish demand. Either they understand that they're... I read it in this way. Either Hamas are so desperate, and they understand that this is their last chance to negotiate anything before Israel really closes in, finishes the job in Rafah, and then dismantles Hamas militarily. Or they're misreading the Israeli population and the Israeli government and thinking that they can get away with these claims. As much as I am compassionate about the families, and I can't imagine what they're going through, how horrible it must have been for more than 4 months to go through the hell that they're living, and I commend them on their efforts. You know, we're in Ramat Gan, in a cafe in Ramat Givatayim, and there's posters everywhere, there's high levels of awareness of it, there are the yellow ribbons on most cars and billboards and everything, and that's great, and I commend them for doing that. As much as I would like to see them back, I don't think that the demands that Hamas are making are even within the realm of negotiable. Either they scale back significantly based on the understanding that we are not going to capitulate and we are not going to just throw away 4 months of fighting, 1,500 casualties, not going to happen. And they adjust, recalibrate their demands. If they don't do that, then I find it very difficult to understand how there will be a deal. I personally am disappointed with the Israeli side. I thought that more than four months after, we would have been successful at saving more Israelis. I actually thought that the IDF, together with the tremendous capabilities of Mossad and Shabak, and then, you know, pooled together, in a special headquarters with resources, you know, no limit on resources for this topic, that we would have been able to get more and more Israelis out. That was my hope and that was my anticipation. I'm sorry that it hasn't happened yet, that only three Israelis have been rescued by Israeli operations. And I hope that now, as we're narrowing in on and closing in on Rafah and have very good control over Khan Yunis, we'll have more opportunities to actually go in and save Israelis by our own capacities. But, you know, we can never write off diplomatic efforts. We have to continue to be there, continue to engage, continue to be relevant, and always, you know, look for opportunities. They may appear and they may show themselves. Maybe Hamas will feel the pressure, understand the predicament that they're in, and understand that they don't have such a strong hand to deal with, and that they have to moderate their requests. So we have to be there and relentlessly continue on the ground and below ground to look for the hostages, to interrogate Hamas terrorists that we apprehend on the ground, and eventually to find our people and get them home. This is a moral obligation that we have, and it's something that the government should have front and center of its list of priorities.
Yes, but Rafah seems to be a more complicated operation, because now you have 1.5 million refugees centered in Rafah.
Yeah.
And the IDF has surrounded Rafah, right? So how do you solve a situation like that?
You know, the beginning of the war, this was about a week and a half after October the 7th, before we even started to maneuver into northern Gaza. If you reach back into distant memory, right, a lot has happened in these 4 months. So a week and a half into the war, there was a very crucial strategic meeting between IDF or Israeli officials and representatives of UN organizations, where the Israelis came and said, listen, you guys know it, we know it, Hamas knows it, the people in Gaza know it. We're going to have to maneuver into Gaza and to fight Hamas. So the first thing we're going to do is to take the northern part. What we need you, the UN, UNRWA, World Health Organization, Red Cross, which isn't UN, but an international NCO, UNICEF and others, we need your help. We don't want to kill civilians. We want them out of the battlefield and we want to focus on the enemy. And we're going to be very kinetic with the enemy, and it's a very dangerous environment to be. So we need your guys' help, move them out, help them out so that they can be in southern Gaza, so that we can focus on the north, and that way we'll have less civilian casualties, we'll only focus on Hamas. The second thing that the Israelis asked was, let's not just ask people to go south and, you know, at random, go south and good luck to you, which is kind of reckless to do and not as responsible as we would like to be. Let's designate the humanitarian zone, the Muassi area, northwest of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. It's a sandy area. It was chosen because it's the only area in Gaza where Hamas doesn't have combat infrastructure underneath. They have it all over, Gaza City, Khan Yunis, the central camps, central Gaza, and of course in Rafah. So those places are not good for civilians to be. The only place where Hamas doesn't have is the Muassi. So we said, you guys, UNRWA, can please help us with establishing a humanitarian zone there, and then we won't fire there, and you'll be able to start building, you know, start building a refugee camp with electricity, with sanitation, with food, with medicine, with everything that refugees in wartime need, or internally displaced people. The answer that Israel got on these two requests was no. We're not going to call on civilians to evacuate, and we're definitely not going to establish a humanitarian zone.
What reason do they have to say that?
So the reason that they gave, and I encounter this a lot in the media, because not only did they not evacuate people, they didn't help people evacuate, they didn't help children and hospitals and people who were in need of assistance to evacuate. They didn't do that, and they didn't do the humanitarian zone. But they also went on a media offensive against Israel, saying that it would be tantamount to war crimes if Israel forcibly expelled people from the area. To which we responded, well, if they stay in that area, they are in mortal danger. I think it is the right thing to do. We are telegraphing our intentions ahead of time, exposing our intentions, and we're asking them to move so that we can fight. How is that a bad thing? But their message was, no, you cannot ask, you cannot forcibly displace, which I find a very strange thing to say. I think it's very cynical and very reckless, because if they would have stayed in northern Gaza, the likelihood of them dying would have been much, much higher. They evacuated, and hence they are alive. Not all of them well, not in great condition, going through hardship and difficulties. Yes, clearly it is war and it isn't easy. But at the end of the day, it's better to suffer for a few months and to be alive than to be dead in your home.
Yeah.
And I found this, you know, that week and a half after the October 7 massacre, then if you remember, it took us almost 3 weeks in order to evacuate northern Gaza. And only then, after about 90% or 85% of the civilian population in northern Gaza had evacuated, after we coerced them and repeatedly called on that, then did we start the fighting. So the situation that we have today in Rafah and in Khan Yunis is a direct result of that UNRWA policy, which of course is in place in order to support Hamas. Hamas told UNRWA, do not evacuate the people. We don't want anybody evacuated. We want them all where they are because we want them as human shields. And UNRWA said, yes, sir, that is where we will keep them. And not only did they not help, but they went on a media offensive in order to try to persuade us not to do so, which was futile from the beginning. Never going to happen that we are not going to attack Hamas, but they tried to stop that from happening. So today, the only thing that I can lament, there are two things that I think are regrettable. One, I think Israel made a strategic mistake by not outing UNRWA early on and releasing the protocols of that meeting and saying, this is what we requested. This is the response that we got. Now, who bears responsibility for civilian suffering? Clearly not us. We are trying to do the right thing. And UNRWA isn't. They are violating the very basic status of their responsibility as a UN body and as a humanitarian organization. They are knowingly putting civilians at risk. And today, and the second thing that we should have done was to take initiative. Because we asked them to, they refused, and we didn't incorporate a plan B. A better plan B would have been for us to build a tent city, a humanitarian zone, close to Kerem Shalom, close to the Israeli border in the south. It's an agricultural area. It could have been done by the IDF, and there could have been others that could have helped. And then UNRWA wouldn't really have had a choice but to join in and to support that effort, because we would have shown it. And that's regrettable that we didn't do that early on, where we didn't put a structured, well-facilitated, and logistically supported humanitarian zone in the southern part, southwestern part of Gaza. That would have been better. What we need to do now is either to build a humanitarian zone in that area, close to Kerem Shalom crossing, or to make sure that it is that it happens in the northern part, the Muassi area. But in any case, Israel needs to make sure that at least the vast majority of civilians, for those the IDPs, internally displaced, and those who live there, that they are evacuated. Because the fighting in Rafah is going to be very kinetic. Israel, in order to finish the job in Rafah, is basically going to have to dig down between 50 and 150 feet, so almost 50 meters deep, in order to get to the deepest tunnels. And it's in a very narrow area. It's about maybe 125, 150 meters wide, the area, the corridor where IDF is going to operate. Lots of Palestinian houses very close up by there. And I'm sure that Hamas, true to their form and true to how they have been fighting so far, will use these houses in order to fire at Israel. We will have to bring down these houses because they're being used by Hamas actively fighting. There will be lots of destruction there. It will be a very dangerous area for civilians to be. And it would be very important for all of the non-combatants to be evacuated away. Every day that goes by and Israel hasn't yet created the conditions in order for people to move away is a day lost. And I think it is within our interest to do that as fast, as effective, and as professional as possible, and to take initiative and lead. Lead and also show, have a live cameras above this camp showing the progress, day and night, live feed, showing the progress. We are now building, Here is the sanitation. Here is electricity. This is where the trucks will offload the humanitarian goods. These are the facilities that people will have. And here's the infirmary. And here are the places that we are preparing for the different humanitarian organizations to work, for the ICRC and for UNICEF and the other organizations that
even
will be
UNRWA?
There. I don't think so, no. I don't think.
Because Martin Griffiths is the deputy director of OCHA.
Yeah.
He has come out and said, as you know, probably, that they don't consider Hamas to be a terrorist organization.
Another travesty from a UN official. Another travesty and another indication of how morally corrupt, how misinformed, how dangerous, and how reckless many people are who hold official office in UN organizations. I think it's so sad. It's not so sad for Israel. You know, let's say that it has some kind of meaning for Israel, but at the end of the day, it doesn't really make a difference. For whom is it really sad? For those who need the help. Palestinians in Gaza, they still need international help. And Palestinians in Gaza have been under Hamas oppressive rule and occupation for a long, long time. And for UN bodies, with the charter, the UN charter, with the freedom and the civil liberties and human rights, for them to claim that Hamas isn't a terrorist organization, and by doing so, lending them legitimacy and political, international political support of almost the highest order, it's a travesty, and it just, you know, serves extremist agendas. It definitely doesn't serve the purposes of those that are supposed to receive support from the UN, the Palestinian civilians.
Since you're not an IDF spokesperson anymore, I can ask you, what do you think about the Americans now? They have not stopped you, Israelis, from conducting the war, but some of the things they say, because you mentioned earlier, for instance, that some of your supposed friends are trying to hold you back or criticizing you for defending yourselves. Anthony Blinken, for instance, he seems to be stretching out his hand to Brazil, who is one of the countries that supports this axis of evil, the Iran, yeah. Russia, and China.
And Hamas. Yes. So, I mean, U.S. support for Israel has been tremendous. We wouldn't have been able to achieve what we've achieved so far. Not on the ground, not in the air, not against Hamas, not against Hezbollah, not protecting our civilians, except for October the 7th, which is on us, but missile defense against incoming ballistic missiles, against rockets, you know. More than 12,000 rockets have been fired at Israel from Gaza. Around 2,500 rockets have been fired from the north, from Hezbollah. And civilian casualties are extremely low. That's thanks a lot through that is, of course, Israeli systems, but U.S. funding and replenishment. Political support has been steadfast. It was tremendous the first 3.5-4 months, and it has been very strong, very clear, super important. Support at the UN and international support and sharing of intelligence and many other things. So all, you know, a general taking stock of U.S. support to Israel, I think the U.S. administration, the Biden administration, has been very solid, and there's tremendous gratitude in Israel for the Biden administration, wall to wall, left, right. People look at a foreign leader, the most important leader in the world, who appears to be paying a political price for supporting Israel, for doing the right thing from an Israeli perspective, and people see that and respect it. And are very, very appreciative of it. Thinking the IDF, very appreciative as well. You know, I think that there's tremendous pressure applied on the administration from within the Democratic Party, fringe elements that support Hamas, that hate America, I think, that hate everything that is liberal, human rights-based, freedom-based, but really support very dark and shameful things, which is their problem. And I'm sad for them, and I'm sad that they are represented in the U.S. Congress, but that's American business. And I think that there's a lot of pressure on the administration to do different things. And I measure things by actions. Action-wise, the US administration, I think, is tremendous. And we are very grateful for it. Statement-wise, there are a few statements that I would rather not have heard, but I can understand the political climate, and I can understand why they're being said. And as long as it doesn't go beyond that, then I think it's something that Israel can live with. One thing that I think is the most tone-deaf thing that I've heard in, I don't know, 10 years or so, is the whole issue of a Palestinian state.
The unilateral acknowledgement of the Palestinian state by Britain and the US.
Yes, by US and Britain. Britain are tagging along after the US said so. That, I think, is very, very unfortunate, because it comes at the worst probable time, and it's simply detached from reality. You know, if you look around in Israel, people, Israelis, want peace. Israelis are willing to make concessions and compromises in order to achieve it. Israel has tried to do so with four different Israeli prime ministers who have made sincere efforts. Some of them, I think, even beyond what's, you know, logical and fair to present. The Olmert plan was extremely, extremely generous, even, I would say, compromising Israeli security. But even that plan was rejected by the Palestinians. Now, when the U.S. goes and says a Palestinian state, who will be the leader of that Palestinian state?
Well, they say the PA.
Yeah, the PA. But the PA today, if elections were held, Hamas wins by a landslide in Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, and in Gaza. Even after 4 months of fighting in Gaza, according to polls that two months ago, Hamas would win. And in Judea and Samaria, 85% success rate of Hamas. So who would be the representative of the Palestinian people? Clearly, if anybody wants to ask the Palestinians, then Hamas is their representative. And then when you hear the United States of America saying, well, there should be unilateral recognition of Palestinian state, well, represented by whom? Clearly not by the corrupt Palestinian Authority, who have no legitimacy, no public support, have no executive capacity to govern the areas that they were given 30 years ago under the Oslo Accords. They have just been conceding area after area, city after city. They've been relinquishing control. So who would govern? And who would be the head of that state? Ismail Haniyeh and Yahya Sinwar? These are the people who lead Hamas, and they are the ones who, if you ask the Palestinians, they would be the representatives of the Palestinian state. And I think it is extremely tone-deaf, and frankly, you know, a bit desperate. It's grasping to even be talking about this now. It's dead in the water. Even the most, you know, strong left-wing peaceniks and supporters of political resolutions in Israel, they look and they say, you know what, maybe not now. You know, let's postpone that with a few years until they get their act in order, and we can see that at least they're represented by an organization that isn't genocidal, maybe that acknowledges Israel's right to exist within defendable borders. You know, let's start with small, and then we'll speak about Jerusalem and land swap areas, Judea and Samaria, and many other things. But let's start with the basics. The Palestinians are today represented by Hamas, and Hamas wants to annihilate Israel and kill all the Jews. That needs to be said. And it isn't. And the fact that proposals, political proposals, are being made.
Yeah, and it will also be seen as a sort of a prize, sort of a reward for terrorism.
The biggest reward you could get. I mean, no other terrorist organization has gotten it. You didn't hear anybody say, after ISIS took control over half of Iraq and Syria, when the fighting was tough, there weren't any proposals to, you know what, let's formalize the Islamic State. I think they should have a state. Hamas is no different. They may have a little bit worse public relations, but they are just as cruel. They proved that on October the 7th. Nobody said that in Afghanistan. Oh, you know what, I think the Taliban, they should be the elected officials. Now, of course, after the U.S. pulled out, they are. But that's the link. The U.S. pulled out, and Taliban came and took control and eradicated all of the small achievements that were made over 20 years of fighting, with many lives lost, trillions of dollars spent. for them to take control again. We are not going to be as reckless. Israel doesn't have the freedom and the leisure to do the same thing, because we would be jeopardizing our own civilians. We wouldn't be able to sit having a nice cup of coffee in Givatayim on a Saturday morning if such a state is founded by Hamas. Wouldn't happen. And Israel and people around the world really need to understand that. And I think that, you know, that the media campaign here is that the Israeli government is against a peace deal. Well, the Israeli government could have communicated it better. I agree. We could have said, yeah, we want peace, but not with Hamas. Hamas is not to have to make peace with. Hamas is to be eliminated. And yeah, let's make peace with the Palestinians, which we have tried four times, but been rejected four times. But let's try a fifth.
I wasn't really going to ask, because present company is excluded, but why are Israelis so bad at PR?
I don't think that we are so bad. I think that this war, Israel has been much better. I've seen different thinking, nothing to do with me. I'm giving credit to decision makers inside the IDF and inside the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and maybe at the governmental level as well, who have been approaching issues differently and allocating more time, resources, and priority to international media. There are, of course, shortcomings. As I said, in hindsight, with the benefit of hindsight, I gave this recommendation in the beginning of the war as well, to take the humanitarian initiative and to front-load the topic and say, you know what, we own it. We care about civilians and we want to do a humanitarian zone and we'll start building it. Come see how we're doing. And then let's dare you not to participate in it. But that was perhaps a bit premature, but I think that Israel, this war has been much better in my subjective experience than what we were in May 21 and what we were in 2014 and also 2006, in how I compare it. But the fact that Israel is overrun media-wise and sometimes diplomatically, I don't think that you can, you know, on an academic point of view, say it's because Israel is lousy at presenting itself. It is also because we are outmanned, outgunned, and out-tweeted, and outreached, and out-algorithmed. Of course, we can and we should be doing better. The example of how we respond to a tone-deaf American initiative, we should probably have said, well, we thank you very much for your desire to bring about peace in the Middle East. We want peace. We would want to make peace with a Palestinian entity that is not led by Hamas and not led by a corrupt and a totally delegitimate Palestinian authority, which doesn't govern. And once those conditions appear, then yes, we will be waiting at the table, ready to make concessions in order to build a good future for the two people here. And that's different than saying no and just, you know, rejecting it. The rejection is a solid one. It's based on, you know, solid reasoning, and I think the proposal...
And experience.
But the way you present it is, of course, it could have been different. And it would have been better for Israel to present it differently.
So let's say the hostage ceasefire talks in Paris now fails, and you have to go in and dismantle Rafah, Hamas in Rafah. Afterwards, what happens then?
So the government reportedly, the prime minister has formulated a plan which stipulates in some of it very broad terms. Have you seen it? Have you said
yes?
Yeah.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So it stipulates in broad terms, some are a bit more specific, some are very vague, I think adequately vague, as to what Israel will need to achieve afterwards. Yeah, I think we're talking about a generational task. This isn't something that Israel will be able to finish in a matter of definitely not a year and not a small amount of years. This will take many years of clever, patient, resource-intense work to do. And it will take leadership, it will take diplomatic skills, it will take creativity, vision, stamina, in order to create the conditions on the ground that will ensure Israeli security, but also change the situation in Gaza in such a way that we will be able to eradicate the long-term toxic influence of Hamas and extremist Islam in the area, and to replace that with a different type of governance that suits Palestinians, doesn't necessarily suit Europe or the US, but suits Palestinians and provides them with stability, with security, with an honorable existence, with something that allows them to be prosperous and have a future to hope for. Not a Palestinian state in Gaza in the immediate future, but something that gives them, ordinary men and women in Gaza, something to wake up and think about and to be proud of, and to, most importantly, be afraid to lose again. And there needs to be a total remodeling of how services are provided in Gaza. The current model where Hamas spends all of its money underground, builds tunnels, buys weapons, produces rockets, and pays their fighters in order to basically train in order to kill Israelis. And then the international community foots the bill for everything above ground through UNRWA and others. That model needs to change. And people around the world need to understand, Israelis need to understand, and people around the world, that the Gazans are not refugees. There are no refugees in Gaza. There are internally displaced people from the war now, and they need to be given support, clearly, but UNRWA needs to be abolished totally. They need to be abolished from Gaza first and foremost, and then other areas of the Middle East. That would be very good for Palestinians and very good for solving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And the whole infrastructure of, you know, international aid given to Gaza, instead of investment in infrastructure in order for them to build and grow their own future, that needs to change. And the whole thinking of Gaza as a charity case, instead of a place which so far has been given, I don't know how many trillions of dollars have been wasted on Gaza.
More than any other displaced or minority status people in the world.
Totally.
Ever.
And it's just, you know, if people are honest around the world, which I don't think that the leaders of the UN are, and I don't think that many Western governments are, but if they for a second take time and pause and say, okay, for 75 years, we operated according to a certain model. The model was, instead of, you know, let's give them a fish. We'll feed them fish every day. You know, the old...
Yes.
Yeah. Let's give them fish every day and make sure that there's a steady supply of fish. And let's also give them money so that they can do other things. The other things they did, instead of, you know, training themselves and building an infrastructure, was jihad. Tunnels, rockets, weapons, and fighters against Israel. What I think we should be doing, and what the interest of the international community should be, what the Israeli interest should be, is to teach them how to fish and give them the fishing rod.
Right.
So that they can start building just like any other population around the world, give them the tools to promote their own future. Israel shouldn't be responsible for Gaza. We should be able to say, okay, now, as long as we control it militarily, we are responsible. Then it is our interest to transition and to get international help in order to transition, eradicate the radical influence of Hamas and other terrorist organizations, and build other institutions that will build a Gazan society in the wake of what Hamas did. And it's a tremendous task. I don't think that we can, you know, think lightly of it. It's going to take a lot of time. It's going to take resources, energy, leadership, diplomatic skills. I'm hoping that within, you know, this generation, we'll start to see change. We'll start to see a Palestinian society that is more human rights based, prosperity based, not jihad based, doesn't, you know, go on with futile ideas of right of return or Al-Aqsa this or Al-Aqsa that. They need to understand that that is a dream of the past which will never materialize. And the sooner they come, as soon as they accept their current situation and understand that it is in their best interest to choose life and choose their own future, that would be better for them. But the longer they continue to cling on to these radical ideas of going back to Yafo and Tel Aviv and Jerusalem and Ashdod and Haifa, it's never going to happen. And as soon as the international community stops indulging them with their extremist dreams, the better for Palestinians.
So you don't seem too worried about a second front opening up in southern Lebanon, north of Israel?
I think that both Israel and Hezbollah and Hezbollah's Iranian masters in Tehran aren't both. So the three of us, and there's a slight difference between Hezbollah and Iran, but of course they're the same. There doesn't appear to be an appetite for war for the current time being. And I think Israel has been tremendously strategically patient with Hezbollah's aggression, with Iranian aggression, simply because Israel wants to focus on Gaza, get that done, finish that militarily, and then start the second phase of transitioning, which will take a lot of diplomatic and military capital. And for the time being, I'm not sure that Israel wants a full-on war with Hezbollah. Had Israel wanted to, Israel would have been totally justified in responding to Hezbollah aggression. More than 3,000 projectiles have been fired at Israel over 4 months. There's been more rocket casualties, more civilian casualties after October the 7th caused by Hezbollah activities than by Hamas activities. And of course, damage to infrastructure, 100,000 Israelis that are displaced from their homes, etc.
So exactly, you need to bring them back to their homes.
They need to go back to their homes, and the war won't end before that happens. Hopefully, some kind of diplomatic solution will be achieved.
You think Nasrallah can afford it? I mean, if he...
That's the problem.
Let's say, if he withdraws beyond the Litani River, then...
I don't think he will.
Because then he would be... Fudged.
Losing face.
Yes.
He would be losing face big time. Regionally, in the jihadi universe, it would be a tremendous loss of face. And he's already been outdone by these low-life Gazans. This is how he looks at Hamas. He's already been outdone by them.
They are Sunni as well.
They are Sunni and they are Gazans, which is, you know, the lowest level on the Arab ladder, socioeconomic ladder. They are the most despised. They are the most expendable, the most despised, lowest down, according to Arabs, not what Israelis think. So Nasrallah is in a kind of a bind, indeed, where he needs to find some kind of way out of it, and he doesn't really have the strategic achievement to show for 4 months of fighting, more than 200 dead Hezbollah operatives. And the only thing that they've achieved so far is that they've killed almost 20 Israelis and 100,000 are temporarily displaced from their homes, which is a big deal. But I'm not sure that it's enough for Hezbollah to be able to agree to a diplomatic solution. Having said that, still, I'm not sure that Hezbollah wants a war, and I'm not sure that their Iranian masters want Hezbollah to go to war, because the strategic purpose of Hezbollah is not to defend Lebanon and it's not to defend Gaza or to help jihadis in Gaza fight Israel. The strategic current purpose of Hezbollah is to be a deterrent against Israel from launching a preemptive strike on Iran's nuclear facilities. That's why Iran keeps funding Hezbollah. That's why Hezbollah is so important.
So your option is to wait until Iran gets the bomb?
No, that's not a good option.
So what do you do?
So unlike Israeli politicians, I don't think that it's a good thing to say out loud in advance what Israel is going to do, what Israel should do in military terms. But allowing Iran to obtain nuclear weapons would be a very, very bad thing for Israel, for the world. And I think that until the equation changes in the Middle East, if we zoom out for a second, you know, we look at 2023, probably the best year in this generation for Iran. When they take stock of 2023, marvelous year. They were able to quash internal dissent. There are no more riots and demonstrations on the street. They murdered, executed, silenced, imprisoned enough people in Iran. By the way, very brave young men and women who went out on the streets against such a brutal regime, sadly didn't receive international support, and they were squashed by the regime. So the regime has been able to do that. Israel, its biggest regional enemy, is busy fighting one of its proxies, not even the biggest Iranian proxy, one of its proxies, Hamas. And the other side, US and the West, seems very much in disarray, I think, from an Iranian perspective. Most importantly, nobody's talking about centrifuges, enrichment, missile technology, and weaponization of nuclear capabilities. That's all, the bandwidth all goes to the sideshow, which is Gaza and Hezbollah. And from an Iranian perspective, that's great. Another thing is that Iran, you know, they set out kind of the perimeters of how they want to promote their long-term strategic needs. They build proxies, and the proxies attack their enemies. They attack Israel, they attack the US. Israel, by and large, except for a few small deviations from it, but Israel, by and large, is responding against the proxies, right? Against Hezbollah, against Hamas, and against Hezbollah, and against Iranian observers in Syria and in other places, but essentially against the proxies. The US is doing the same thing, being attacked by proxies and responding against the proxies, whether it's the Houthis, Ansar Allah in Syria, Kataib Hezbollah, and whatever it is, they're responding against them. As long as Iran has the ability to sustain and provide these operations, I think they will continue. As long as their sources of revenue are not affected, as long as oil keeps on flowing, as long as gas keeps on flowing, or flowing liquid in the air state, then Iran would have the ability to continue to fund these proxies, and they wouldn't really be forced to change their strategy.
So why do you think the US response has been so weak? And I'm not talking about the US response to Hamas attack on Israel. I'm talking about the US response to the Iranian proxies attack on the US.
Yeah, I wouldn't characterize it like you said. I would say that as long as this remains Israeli and US responses, there's nothing that forces Iran to change strategy and course. What I think is needed is to strike Iran in such a way that it creates a real strategic dilemma for them how to continue, to up the price, to put a much more significant price tag on. If you continue with these proxies, then you won't be exporting any more oil.
Okay, so economic sanctions would be an option.
Not sanctions.
Not sanctions?
No, sanctions don't work. They worked for maybe a year, year and a half, but Iran has found creative ways, together with their allies, Russia, China, and together with trade partners like India, to circumvent the sanctions. They're not effective. And they don't. They've found, money laundering schemes in the UAE and in Qatar. And there are, it's a bit of an inconvenience, but money's getting in, oil is getting out, and trade is ongoing. They just turn off the transponders of the ships when they go into the, when they cross Bandar Abbas, load Iranian oil, and then they flag it as another origin of oil, and then they get money indirectly from other sources. They're circumventing the dollar. They're very cleverly overcoming the sanctions in place. So sanctions would be great if they worked. I don't think that they are.
So what does that mean?
I mean, if sanctions is not what you're suggesting here.
To create the strategic dilemma for Iran, if they want to continue with funding proxies, this is the price that you pay. Up until now, a certain set of tools have been used, and Israel has been responding against proxies. The US has been responding against proxies. That doesn't appear to be working. And the Iranians are promoting their strategic interest in the region unabatedly, with tremendous success. So if Israel wants to change that, you know, as Einstein said, it's lunacy to do the same thing over and over and expect a different result. Then stop doing the same thing and think different. Do different.
Because what I'm hearing between the lines here is a direct strike on Iran.
Yeah, I don't think that should be excluded. I think that should definitely be a part of the tools that are available. Israel has the capacity to do so. Of course, the US has the capacity. But I speak about Israel. I don't, you know, provide guidance for the US government. I speak about Israel. Israel has the capacity to do so. And, you know, I think that the Iranians are between greatly and just overestimated. I don't know if they're greatly overestimated or just overestimated in terms of their fighting capabilities. And let's put them to test. So far, we've seen that they're excellent puppeteers and they're best in the world when it comes to proxy organizations. Let's see how good they are defending their homeland.
I think they would be bad. They need their military to keep their own population in check.
Only one way of finding out.
Indeed. So what is China's role in all this?
China is a major trade partner with Iran. China serves, of course, as the biggest strategic competitor and threat for the US and forces the US to divert a lot of resources that way. Strategically speaking, for many years, the US has had this desire to or spoken strategy of pivoting east in order to mitigate Chinese belligerence in Southeast Asia and in other locations. And that, of course, influences how the US operates in the Middle East. And then that influences Israel, and it influences Israel's enemies, and it influences possible trade partners and possible peace partners of Israel. A strong US in the region, with strong, steady presence, strong deterrence, and a good correlation between statements and actions, is something that brings stability to the region. And I think can facilitate normalization deals, peace treaties, prosperity, rebuilding of Gaza, etc. For some countries in the region, China is an option, right? The Saudis made diplomatic overtures and agreements with the Chinese because they, I think, expressed a certain dissatisfaction with American commitment, which I think is very regrettable. I think China's, you know, they've been making inroads into the Middle East more as a way of antagonizing the U.S. And insulting the U.S. than really caring about the Middle East. And for them, the diplomatic win of managing a deal between Iran and the Saudis, yeah, that was a good win for them. I think it should be a wake-up call for everybody involved in the region, for the U.S. and others. But I think that we're still in a situation where it's reversible. U.S. presence, U.S. dominance, it's reversible, and that there can be, if there are strong statements, leadership and action, then China can be relegated to be a regional Southeast Asian player, of course, global economy, etc., but not have as much influence in the Middle East.
So what about Russia? How has Israel's relationship to Russia changed after October 7th?
I think Russia, in my mind, is exposed as a supporter of terrorism, a supporter, again, of our enemies. Before it was Syria and Iran, including strategic support of Iran with ballistic missile technology, satellite technology. and other strategic capabilities. Now they're also openly supporting Hamas. And I am not, of course, a decision maker, and I'm not, you know, I don't see the whole spectrum of considerations, but I see an Israel policy towards Russia, which continues to be a very, very cautious one, where we are not calling out Russia for what it is, a backward country that invaded another country, and from our perspective, supports our enemies. They've been supporting Russia, and the Soviet Union have been supporting our enemies for a long, long time, since before 67. And of course, Israel is smart about it, tries to balance the situation. But I think that in my subjective point of view, if we look at how Russia was before October the 7th and how it is today, I think that it has gone down even further on the level of the moral level of that country, hosting Hamas delegations, making statements about, you know, supporting Hamas, supporting ceasefire, and basically doing the dirty work of Hamas. Regrettable, not surprising, but again, you know, many countries, institutions, people, October 7 was a giant masks off moment for many people around the world. Russia, I mean, it wasn't that as if we didn't know what Russia is, but I think that after this, it's even clearer what Russia is.
So on the grandest scale, talking about this troika of China, Russia and Iran, what do you think the free world's response should be?
I think that the best way is to defeat organizations, entities, and, you know, autocratic societies like this. This is how it's been done in the past with other regimes that were similar, by outworking, outproducing, and outfighting where necessary, but by deterring when not necessary to fight. And I think that's the way to deal with them. To outproduce, outfight, to be united, you know, Europe and the US. You know, I listened to the Economist podcast yesterday, and they were doing a 2-year summary, all a bunch of British men, no women and no people of color, but a bunch of British guys were discussing between themselves the situation, taking stock of 2 years of war. And about a quarter of it was criticizing the US for not doing more when it comes to Ukraine. And I was doing the dishes. And I stopped for a second. I said, what on earth are they talking about, these lovely Europeans? Why don't they do more? It's not as if they don't have the money. It's not as if they don't have the capacity. And it's not as if it doesn't concern them. But there's this reluctance to do and willingness to talk on behalf of Europeans. And that's very conducive for regimes like Iran, like Russia, like China. The Iranians are a prime example of that. On one hand, you know, there are allegedly sanctions imposed on Iran. But then European companies are stumbling over each other in order to make business with this evil regime.
But so is Israel. I mean, the port of Haifa is Chinese now, isn't it?
No, it's actually Indian.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay.
I am happy that...
thought it was Chinese.
Well, there was a Chinese tender, and I think that the Israeli government agreed or partially agreed to it. I don't know the fine details of the deal specifically. But then there was a very legitimate American demand. We don't want that. And then Israel made the necessary adjustments. And the company that is building it is an Indian company. I wish that U.S. companies or Israeli companies would be capable of doing it by themselves, or that U.S. companies would hand in, you know, competitive offers. Hasn't been the case. The Chinese companies handed in very competitive offers, and that's why they were chosen. But There were difficulties in negotiations, and the deal didn't materialize. It's an Indian company, and I'm not aware of any Chinese-owned companies winning official grants in Israel for the last, I'd say, year and a half, 2 years. I don't know if that's by design or it's just chance. I don't know. But I'm just looking at, you know, results of it, and I'm not seeing it. So unity, right, is important for Europe and the US, for the free world to be united. Of course, there will be differences. Unity doesn't mean that it's groupthink and everybody says the same. But to really recognize what's important and to fight those evil and dark regimes, autocratic regimes that do not respect civil rights, civil liberties, the rule of law, and international order, these societies, these regimes, should be fought against by the free countries. Something that never ceased to amaze me, I was seconded to the UN, right? I was on loan behalf of the IDF to the UN. And I'd sit in just out of sheer interest. Out of sheer interest, I would sit in on General Assembly sessions and see the voting and be behind the scenes and look at deliberations before, and also Security Council, but less about Security Council, General Assembly. To me, it's amazing that the most vile and dark dictatorships in the world, pick a country, have the same voting power as the best democracies in the world, right? Countries like Sweden, which there's rule of law, and there's civil liberties, and there's environmental policies, and there's respect for others, and there's a lot of beautiful things that I think should be shared around the world. They have the same vote as Afghanistan, or as, I don't know if Somalia has a vote, Somalia probably has a vote, and Russia and China. Russia and China on the Security Council. I think that organizations like the UN, there should be a level of percentage. One vote is if you're a democracy and there's respect for civil rights, liberties, rule of law, and there's a functioning justice system. That should be one complete vote. And then it should be levels below that. So a country, corrupt autocratic regimes shouldn't have the same say in international institutions. The Human Rights Council is governed by autocratic countries, by totalitarian regimes, and they're signaling out democratic countries like Israel. Iran presides over committees in the Human Rights Council. China presides over committees. It's just absurd. So democracies need to, get their act together when it comes to speaking in one voice and thinking about what's really important, and then gear economies, their output, and their diplomatic clout in order to fight for what's right. And Israel, if I look at it from my perspective, Israel should have international support, European and American support. Iran should not. Palestinians should not be indulged as they are.
Are you worried about your relatives abroad?
I am concerned that it would be difficult for me to go see my relatives abroad, specifically in Sweden, which is unfortunate. Of course, there have been threats threats made towards my family in Sweden, which I think is very sad. And whenever I travel abroad, I have to take certain considerations depending on where I go and whom I meet. But that's a price that I am personally willing to pay in order to continue to, for the greater good, to do something that's good for Israel. I hope that nobody will involve my family. That would be very, very sad and unfortunate and, of course, reprehensible. And up until now, that hasn't happened. But the type of people that we deal with, I am concerned by the fact that nothing seems to be below them. The enemies of Israel and people that have been marching the streets of Malmo and Stockholm after October the 7th, chanting from the river to the sea, and many other catchy slogans, are people that are basically saying we want to commit genocide. So I am concerned that maybe others would think that it's a good idea to do something negative. But that we shouldn't let that deter us.
You've done a tremendous job, Jonathan. I'm so honored that I get to interview you, and this is the third time. Thank you for participating.
Thank you. The respect is absolutely mutual, and I thank you for the opportunity.
To our listeners, thank you for tuning in to Deconstructive Criticism. This episode's guest was Lieutenant Colonel Reservist Jonathan Conricus. Follow Jonathan's insights on the platform formerly known as Twitter, now X. We are immensely grateful to our special donors for their contributions. If you wish to contribute, join us at Patreon at patreon.com/Aaron Flam or make a donation via Swish at 0768-943737 if you're in Sweden. I'm Aaron Flam. Until next time, have a good unit of time.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.